CliffCentral.com.
Very nice. It is nice.
I told you I watched Borat, the new Borat movie over the weekend.
Yes.
Fantastic. Oh, I loved it. So clever. I can't say enough good things about it. Anyway, loads of things to get into this morning, and you can join us on 0797482090 with your messages, and you can also be a part of the live stream this morning. You can watch us live if you go to cliffcentral.com and click on the link. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to see you. All right. First of all, are you getting ready for Christmas? Because Christmas is just around the corner. I know that many people hate hearing about Christmas in November. It's maybe too soon for some people. But the shops are already stocked with all the Christmas decorations, and Christmas trees are going up in the shopping malls, and that gives all of us the feeling that it's almost holiday. Apparently on Lotto Land, there is the famous Christmas Lottery. Now, we heard about this from Marika the other day. The Spanish Christmas Lottery is the biggest lottery in the world. Listen to this. Hmm. Yeah, it's huge. This incredible event takes place on the 22nd of December in Madrid. There's a collective prize pool of 45.3 billion rand. I'll say that again because it's 45.3 billion rand. If you're not one of the lucky punters winning the El Gordo in Spain, there is a massive 1 in 7 chance that you at least win a lower tier prize. But that's amazing, a 1 in 7 chance. So don't miss out on this fun event. Go to lottoland.co.za. Lottoland South Africa is a licensed bookmaker with the Western Cape Gambling and Racing Board. No persons under the age of 18 are permitted to gamble. Winners know when to stop, and the National Responsible Gambling Toll-Free Counseling Line is on 0800 006 008. It's a huge amount of money. I love the way they call it El Gordo. So we've got to tell Gord tomorrow. That's the big one. Gord is actually named El Gordo because he's the big one. He's the biggest guy on the show by far.
Don't you think? But that's why he's named Gord.
Mm-hmm. His parents knew. They just knew.
Yeah.
Monwa says, I will be working on Christmas. Money over fake family fun. Sure, Monwa. Woody says, to parents, now is the perfect time to tell your children that Santa Claus died from COVID. We've got great people listening to us.
No,
Vernon says, didn't you hear Christmas got cancelled this year?
Why is Christmas cancelled?
I don't know, COVID. It's a good excuse for everything these days. Anything people don't want to do, they just go, COVID.
Good point.
Yeah.
No, I just can't believe that we're heading to the new year already then.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Look, you and I were counting yesterday that we are 22 weeks into
the TV show.
And that was surprising to me, at least.
Hey,
that's almost half a year.
While we're talking about that, we've got a fantastic show for you on Wednesday. It's all about political correctness. And you're going to love it. The guests are terrific. The conversation goes everywhere you want it to go. And we've got some very interesting insights there, including Jason Goliath on the show. So don't miss it. That's So What Now, ENCA, this week, Wednesday. That's tomorrow night at 8:30 on Channel 403. Make sure you don't miss it.
You know it's a lot when the control room, people who are meant to, you know, just be focusing on the lights or the camera,
mm-hmm.
just as... we have an audience here. But you know, there's so much behind the scenes that people don't get to see.
Well, I don't even get to see that because you are...
Oh, right. Yes. You're working in...
Yeah, you're in the control room, so you get to hear things and see things that I don't even get to see, so... I don't often know what's going on during the show from a broadcast point of view until I see it on TV myself.
But outside, I'll point this out to you next week maybe, Gareth. There I've noticed a cove of these reputable anchors, very serious people on TV. It's almost like they all sit in this dark corner outside, all smoking away.
Yeah.
And so... if you really walk by too quickly, you'll lose them. But you just see these little puffs of smoke. I kid you not.
Oh,
it's like, wait a minute.
Is it vape pens?
That's vape and cigarettes,
Oh,
and they're
wow.
just puffing away all there. And it was only because I now regularly park there because I know that's where I'll always find parking. Yesterday that I specifically noticed there's a sign that has been put up. And you know, when a sign is put up, it is after several encounters, in my assumption, of people trying to ward and they stop you and you don't listen. So now a sign needs to be put up, a sign that says smoking of cannabis not allowed.
Wow.
What are these people doing before the 5 o'clock bulletin? Just they're like buffing away.
Wow. So I've bumped into a few of them. I met Tulasizwe Simelane yesterday for the first time. I met, who else is there that I've seen? Evusi. What's his name? Anyway, he's their political
Salt and pepper beer.
Yeah, he's got the Evusi. It's just slipped my mind now, but I met him the other day. I've met a couple of them. So they all work very hard. I mean, that place is insane. It's a huge amount of work that goes into producing news. Thankfully, we just go in and do our show. Anyway, we do have someone called Anne Jangle who's going to join us later on. She is doing a solo cycle from South Africa to Kenya, and we'll find out what she's all about and what she's doing this for. Because every time I hear about someone who's doing a cycling, I'm like, don't make your cycling everyone else's problem. So I'll ask her about
it. My question to her is, what possessed her to do this? Yeah. Why would you take 7 months out of your life? And look, she survived and she can tell the tale of traveling 7 months alone on a bicycle.
Yeah,
why would you risk that?
The reason I'd be interested to talk to her and the reason we are talking to her today is because she's been through all of these amazing countries and she's seen things because she's been on a bicycle that we wouldn't normally see if we were there in a car or a plane. So it'll be interesting to have her insights from that point of view. We'll find out. She also had zero cycling experience prior to the trip, but she says she had the time of her life. So we'll find out about that. Gareth, why did you think Borat was so good? I also watched it this weekend. That's from Tracy. Well, Tracy, it's so clever the way they weave the coronavirus in, the way they weave the American political story in. I thought that Borat as a character is extremely clever because he's actually a very sympathetic character, despite being a complete idiot. And I just looked for a little more depth than maybe just to be entertained. And if you disagree, I mean, I'm happy for you to argue with me about it if you'd like to disagree. I thought it was a very clever movie. And there haven't been that many clever movies on this show, in this year, I'm afraid. It's been a very dry year. Vernon says 2021 has also been cancelled. I'm sorry, guys. Vernon is so positive and optimistic today. Demon Dad says, you recently had a urologist on the show, and he recommended men empty their bladder regularly. Get him on again. I have so much... Oh, this is not bladder. He means balls. Get him on again. I have so much sex that my balls hurt. Is that normal? Is 3 times a day too much? Yo, Demon Dad. I don't know. Honestly, 3 times a day, sure. Sounds like a lot of work, man.
I don't know what to say.
Yeah,
I think
we'll leave it alone.
Anyway, hey, did you see that photo of Agritzi supposedly in ICU yesterday?
No. Tell me about it. He's in hospital.
He's in hospital. And from what they say in the article as well, that he's in ICU and the photo is him lying, you know, with back down and stomach up, just covered in like tubes and wires and whatnot. You can't even see his face properly, but he's just lying there, somewhat lifeless.
Mm-hmm.
But he just so casually happens to have the book that he's currently promoting lying on his chest.
Please.
Now, I am also not a doctor, but I have watched enough like 17 seconds of Grey's Anatomy to piece together, that if there are machines that you are connected to, there should be some sort of light on a machine, a number on, a bright red dot. All of the machines in the photo are completely off.
Oh my God.
So, like, what are they trying to make us believe in this? So they're still saying that he's in ICU, and the piece is it's currently in Daily Maverick, and it is around Akritzi just speaking very one-on-one with Melinda Ferguson, and he says in there that, you know, people are out to try and kill him. They tried to kill him twice, and he supposedly just poured his heart out to Melinda Ferguson when he was, you know, just barely awake. But I just love this perfect publicity photo that was released yesterday.
It's horrible. He's also a major feature of what's the book? Mandy Wiener's book, Whistleblowers.
Right. Yeah.
And
but
yeah.
Yeah, well, this one being his book that he's
promoting,
called Inside the Belly of the Beast, the real Bosasa story.
Yeah,
so
I'm
he's
not,
the victim.
I'm not so interested in Angelo Agrizi. Forgive me. I think all the stuff that he said at the State Capture Commission's good and well, and any person with a conscience should unburden themselves of any tenderpreneurship or corruption and fraud that they've been involved in, which is beyond the pale. And I think that's just a duty. I don't believe we should celebrate this man as some kind of hero just because he said that he told the truth to a commission of inquiry. I think that's what everybody should do. That should be our base standard. That should be our starting point. We shouldn't be thinking that this guy is in some way a victim. And for him to pose for this photo, because clearly it's a posed photo, they should get him the hell out of that hospital, because clearly there's nothing wrong with him.
And also, so just because you are honest about what you saw or what you did or what you saw others did do, doesn't mean that you are now going to be innocent. I still think you need to be held accountable. If there's going to be something that comes at you, ask Geese. Well, that's the way life goes. But just think because you've testified, you're now the victim and everyone must praise you for it.
I think the only way to get businesses like Bosasa to be responsible is to actually hold everyone in the business accountable. In other words, to say that anyone who saw any corruption taking place and didn't say anything is as guilty as the person who was doing the corrupt deed. Because then people will hold their bosses responsible, they'll hold their employees responsible. There'll be a lot more accountability in these businesses. I think that there's got to be a way that we actually make sure that everybody in a business, from the tea lady to the cleaner to the CEO, you know, if there's corruption, everybody gets hauled in front of a commission. Everybody. Because if you turned a blind eye, if you walked into a room and you heard Agrizi and Gavin Watson talking to Nomvula Mokonyane about government money and you heard just enough to know that there's some allegation of corruption, and you didn't report it to anyone, maybe you should be held responsible. I'm just thinking that could be a way to sort out some of the problems. But I don't know.
Everyone knows something.
Yeah, and I think you should be, as a good person, it should be incumbent on you to share that information with the rest of us. Tracy is back with some other comments about the Borat movie. She says, I just saw the U.S. politics and COVID narrative as topical, and Sacha Baron Cohen making a statement, so it all made sense. I took it for granted. Okay. I mean, listen, you don't have to think about anything particularly deeply, but I thought it was very clever the way that he laid it out. The whole COVID story, how he involved himself in it and everything else. So good for him. I really think that's interesting. And if you haven't seen it, then don't worry. Hey, Anne Jangle. You got to unmute yourself. You there?
Hi.
Okay.
Hey. Is it working?
Yeah, it's working now. It's all good. So listen, we hear a lot about what happens around Africa. We've even got JJ Cornish, who comes in every couple of days to tell us what's going on in African analysis. But some stories are true, some are exaggerations. And I thought it would be fun to hear from somebody who's experienced a whole bunch of these countries on foot, or in this case on bicycle, Anne Jangle is a musician who was determined to see Africa with fresh eyes to find out for herself what endangered wildlife is going through and experience the richness of African communities in various countries. The trip took 7 months. When exactly did you do this trip?
I started on my birthday on the 11th of June last year.
And you went for 7 months from then. You made it.
Yeah.
You made it just in time before COVID came down, right?
I did. I kind of wish that COVID maybe came a little sooner so I could have been stuck in Kenya or something. That would have been really cool.
Would you have liked that for a whole, 6 months or whatever?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
It's amazing.
But, how would you have even lived? I mean, you can't do things from Kenya that you would do here.
Well, that depends. If you're living in a tiny little shack on the beach, then you can definitely just stay in paradise and not, I wouldn't mind not leaving my house. I was stuck in a tiny little house with some coconut palm trees, you know.
Well, it doesn't take much to please you. I mean, I'm happy for you.
No, so, simple life.
So Anne has traveled from South Africa to Botswana, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Malawi, Tanzania, and Kenya. I think you're kind of crazy, which is why I wanted to talk to you this morning. Because first of all, a bicycle is a very uncomfortable thing. Second of all, this sounds like it sounds like the kind of thing that would be my worst nightmare. So you're exactly the opposite of me in this respect. I would hate to be traveling through villages and along dusty roads. I would hate this. This would I don't know how. I mean, maybe you're some kind of filthy hippie, but I would like to wash.
Not a shave.
I'm just thinking about the cramping. Ooh.
Thank God for that.
Yeah.
All right, so
it was really, really crazy in the beginning. I'm not a cyclist. I just cycled to Kenya, but I didn't really know what I was in for. I mean, I learned how to change a bicycle tire a week before I started, so I really had no idea. I didn't know about headwind. I didn't know about anything. I kind of just learned as I went along.
So, how many times did you have to change a tire?
So me by myself alone, I only changed it twice, where every other time there were just these, can I say, angels that would just appear out of nowhere and just park next to you and be like, don't worry, we got you, da-da-da-da-da, fix the tire, and then off they went. I'm like, what? Where did that come from?
Amazing. So tell me about the actual experience of the trip. Did you go entirely on your own?
Yeah. I did a tour.
Weren't you a little bit worried about that? I mean, you know, you're a woman on your own, and there are some places which are, you hear these stories about these couples, these, you know, starry-eyed couples who go through like Afghanistan on bicycles, and we've all seen this in the news, and then they get murdered by the locals, and, you know, they get their skin gets made into like a blanket. And and I think of those stories, and I'm like, well, I'm rather not going to get on a bicycle and drive through. And I'm not saying that any of these
Do you ever fly? Do you get in an airplane and fly? Because I've heard of some planes going down. So
Yeah.
Same thing. It really is the same thing. And if we're going to let fear stop us from doing anything, then I don't know. What's the point of living?
All right.
I met this woman, and this is why I was pretty confident in doing what I did. And her name is Blanca Fernandez. You can Google it, Blanca on a bike. She, at the age of 60, I met her in Kenton, which is in the Eastern Cape of South Africa. And she had cycled from London to Ghana by herself, flew to Egypt, went Egypt to Cape Town by the east coast of Africa, and back to London, east coast of Africa, at the age of 60.
Oy.
So I figured,
just hearing that.
Exactly.
Crazy
woman
old,
alone.
Crazy
I thought,
old
Jesus,
bat.
This woman can do it. You know, surely I can do it.
All right,
couple of countries.
So what were you hoping to see and what were you hoping to experience?
I wanted discomfort. I wanted to see who I would bring the planet with in a very raw setting. I wanted to see for myself how our different cultures live, beliefs, why animals were being treated the way they were being treated. I needed to see it for myself. I'm also a very stubborn human being, so if I start something, there's no way in hell I can quit. So I have to see it through. I mean, obviously there were many times when I was really, I got a little bit sick, like in Zambia. I think I drank some wrong water and I was stuck in my tent for 2 days, sweating and vomiting and
you
things.
See,
I couldn't
I
get
just,
out of my tent.
I do not understand people like you at all. It drives me up the wall. I mean, like, I love your spirit of adventure and all the rest. It's something I do not have at all. And I don't get why you'd want to put yourself in a situation where you're pooing and vomiting water because you drank something that was horrible.
In a tent.
And the only thing you've got to look forward to the next day is another couple of hundred kilometers on a fucking bicycle. You're mad.
I know. But once you start doing it, like the adrenaline and the fresh air and just the people, the kindness, it's such a beautiful, addictive thing. Waking up in the middle of nowhere and all you hear are the birds and you make a little fire and you make your coffee and just there's just this blanket of gratitude that comes over you. And coming from an extremely music infested rock and roll travel, you know, like hectic nights and like then coming from that lifestyle and just going into this extreme different experience was just such a game changer, man. It like really touched me.
All right, let me ask you this though, because most of us can't just up and leave. I mean, many people have responsibilities. I mean, you have a music career, but clearly you decided it's worth putting that on hold for 7 months, or you used it to, I don't know, compose some music or whatever. You take an instrument with you?
Yes, I took a Martin Mini backpacker's guitar, a very, very small one, and I strapped that to my bicycle.
Okay. So 7 months is a long time for most of us to just up and leave. You obviously didn't have any serious responsibilities that you had to worry about.
No, I don't want kids. I'm not married, no relationship. No, I'm not a weird nun person. I just, I think maybe I'm a little bit selfish.
You don't have to explain that. I get that completely.
Thanks. So, I literally sold everything I had before I went on this mission. Look, I was living in Europe for a couple of years. We played a lot of shows there. The last tour I did was like 30 gigs in 31 days, crossing over 11 borders. And I just remember I was like so tired, man. I was just so over it. Anyway, I moved back to South Africa because my whole family said I'm getting old and I should settle down. And I was like, how do you settle down? Like, what does this even mean? And then I thought, you get a dog. I mean, that's how you settle down.
Right.
So I went to Animal Anti-Cruelty League and I adopted my dog, Kevin.
Kevin, I love
Kevin
that.
Kevin and I decided, we're not settling down. We're going to get a van. So we lived in my van for a year, traveling all around South Africa. We did about 23,000 kilometers. It was myself, my sound guy, Mike, and my trumpet player, and my dog, Kevin. And we raised over 3 tons of dog food for domestic animals. So we just donated to the area, the animal organizations in the area where we played music. And then from there, I played my last show in Mozambique, and it was a month before that I met Blanca, and I decided that I was going to cycle to Kenya because I got invited to play at the Kalifi Festival for New Year's in Kenya. So initially I was going to drive there, and I was looking at all like crazy ideas, like a beach buggy or a bike with a sidecar, and I could put my dog Kevin in the sidecar or whatever. And then eventually I met Blanca, and I was like, oh, damn it.
Tell me,
my mind already decided I was going to cycle.
What do you have to take with you? Like, what's on your list of stuff? Because you can only carry so much if you're on a bicycle. It's not like you weren't one of those people who had like a van following you with all of the shit that you were going to take with you, right?
Yeah, no, nothing. So that was quite strange. Going from having a van full of crap and then just having bare necessities, the things that you need, like your tent, your cooking pot, sunblock. And
how much cash do you take and what currency?
So I had about only like a, a, probably like a couple of hundred rand cash on me. And then I would draw money once in every country. But also I tried to not work with the whole cash thing. And, you know, when you have a guitar, you can pretty much make it anywhere. You can have accommodation, you'll have food, you'll always connect with people on the same wavelength. So I usually played a lot of music for food and accommodation.
Yeah, so you were mooching.
If that's what you want to call it, Gareth.
Fucking musician who wants free stuff. Play me a song and I'll give you a supper.
I was working for my food.
Right. Okay. No, I kind of admire the spirit of adventure. It's not something that I would ever do. What did you see that really influenced and affected you? Because you must have met with really interesting people. You must have gone off the beaten track in some ways. There must have been some moments where you were frightened. There must have been some moments where you were really elated.
Yeah, my first really scary experience was, especially coming from South Africa, you always think as a woman, every person wants to rape or attack you when you're in the middle of nowhere. So I remember Botswana, my first country, I was cycling a good couple of days in, and there was a truck stuck on the side of the road that had broken down. And I immediately thought, oh my gosh, this guy knows he's been following me since the border. This guy's just broken down there. He's pretending to have been broken down. I'm probably going to get raped now. Okay. Oh, my word. I can't believe it. This dude is like, we're in the middle of nowhere. What a stupid place to break down. And he's like standing there the whole time. I mean, I've been watching this truck broken down the side of the road for a good couple of hours now cycling. Eventually, I get to the truck and this guy like pops out with some water. He's like, you want water? I was like, wow. Thanks, no, but cool, thanks. And then I remember saying then and there to myself, I was like, listen, get it together, you little wuss. This is crap. You're gonna have some faith. You're gonna have faith, you're gonna toughen up because you got a long ass journey ahead of you.
Right.
So if you're gonna be paranoid like that the whole way, then that's gonna be a problem. So I left it. I just stopped, I cut it. Every time these thoughts would come into my head, I was like, you need to learn to trust. And the more I did that, the more beautiful things just became. It was almost, I'm going to sound like such an asshole, I don't mean to, but it's almost like the further I went from South Africa, the safer I felt. And the people became warmer and more friendly and more trustworthy. I mean, by the time I got to Tanzania, I had my first nap on the side of the road. I just,
you just slept
put my little...
Just stop.
Hat on my head next to my bicycle, and I slept for like 2 hours. It was great. I woke up. No one touched anything. Girl. I was even offered some fruit. Yeah, it was cool.
It's amazing.
This is so unnerving to me. Yeah. I have anxiety just thinking about this. I don't know where you... I'll at least admit that for most of us, we get a sense of comfort and security in our daily lives, in our routine, and to abandon all of that is the thrill where you get your comfort to always never know what's happening. Is that what is exciting to you?
I think it's also my personality, the fact that I don't I've never been one to stay in one place for too long. I've always been on the move since a really young age. So I guess I'm used to it. Comfort to me, to own a house or to have these things that tie me down, they kind of give me a bit of anxiety. So,
you know, it's different.
For me, I love.
It's amazing. Like different stuff for different people.
I'm
absolutely blown away that for 7 months of your life, I mean, you'll always have a story. You know, this is so much better a story than many of us will have. Oh, I had that great night out, or I went for this amazing lunch somewhere. And you've got like, I've had a 7 month bicycle journey through Africa. Shut up.
Yeah.
I get it.
Elephant encounters in Botswana. I had a hyena off my head through my tent.
Wow.
So it's wild, eh? It's wild.
Well, I'm glad you survived. I think you're insane, but I love that you did this. And well done for doing it for all kinds of good reasons too. I mean, you said that the endangered animals that you were interested in were part of this plan. And I know you've been, you know, doing bits and pieces all over to raise money for animals. especially for domestic animals. Where did you put Kevin while you were on the 7-month journey?
So just before I started the journey, I accidentally adopted another dog called Kezi.
So you're basically...
I teach her a little bit of English. You know, she's English now. But the two of them stayed at my friend Melissa's house, and she watched them here in Muizenberg in Cape Town.
Poor, everyone in your life has to take on your responsibilities for you. It's ridiculous.
My gigantic responsibilities.
Yeah, you're such an just please stay away from me because I'm not taking on any of your responsibilities, all right?
Why, Garrett?
Because I don't...
But maybe you'd want to meet Kevin.
No, nah, you're right. Huh? I'm okay. You look after Kevin.
Kevin and an ice cream or something, you know?
Listen, keep doing cool things and keep living your best life. I mean, I think it's it's really exciting that you do these things. Why don't you write a book? Did you take pictures while you were doing this?
Loads. I've actually got my documentary that just released now.
Okay, good.
Called African Dream Parade. It's a 30-minute documentary. It's all the footage I took with my phone throughout Africa, and it's literally just released yesterday.
Magic. Well, listen, nice to meet you, and congratulations, and keep doing the music too, huh?
Yeah, man, thanks so much.
All right, what a pleasure. There we go. That's Anne Jangle on cliffcentral.com this morning. I'm telling you, people are crazy. There's no way there's no way I'd ever find myself on a bicycle seat through 7 months of dirt roads. Are you insane?
No. You know, everything that she was talking about, the bliss and how great it was, for me would need a mini pharmacy of medication to endure.
That's why I asked her, what do you take with you? And she's like, well, cooking pots and, you know, that sort of bullshit. And then a guitar and some currency. I would not be able to last 2 days, let alone 7 months. So she's better than me.
Said, she said a blanket of something, and I thought, I was thinking, yeah, a real blanket's fine.
Blanket of kindness, yeah.
Yeah, you could use a real blanket at home with a, you know, 1,000 thread count.
You know, how about it's amazing to me. Like, she and I belong to the same species of creature. We're both human beings, but we both want such different things from our lives. There's nothing about her life that I want, and there's nothing about my life that she wants. Nothing.
But it's so amazing. Cool that we really live in this world where you can do what you want. You go and cycle for 7 months, and that's what gets you going, and you know, that's cool then. Yeah, the documentary is available on YouTube.
Okay, very good. So that's Anne Jangle. Her name suits her.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Government.
Yeah, that's a real name, Anne Jangle. All right, listen, it's time for an episode of Blind History. You know, every Tuesday we check in on one of the famous people from history, and we've recorded a couple of really, really amazing episodes of people that I didn't even necessarily want to. They weren't on my list of, like, these are the, you know, the top 10 people I want to cover in this season of Blind History. We've just thrown in a bunch of names. We've even taken suggestions from people who listen to the series. And today we are going to Arabia, a modern Englishman who can only dream of a life of adventure. And even Anne Jangle would love a life of adventure like this man had. Lawrence of Arabia, exploration, excitement, provenance, and I think largely the days of that kind of exploration are over. But the enduring spirit of T.E. Lawrence and his influence in the Middle East is something which continues to be felt. He may only be familiar to you because of the movie, but his life was probably even more epic. Go and take a listen now to the story of Lawrence of Arabia in Blind History, Season 4, Episode 8. In 1935, A.W. Lawrence sent out a note for his brother's funeral. The body will be taken in a plain coffin wrapped in a Union Jack from the little mortuary chapel today for burial in the village cemetery of Morton. There will be no flowers on the coffin and no inscription. No guard of honor will line the route, and the mourners, whatever their rank, will wear plain clothes. For the same man, Winston Churchill himself had this to say:
I fear, whatever our need, we shall never see his like again. The funeral was for T.E. Lawrence, who would forever be known as Lawrence of Arabia.
Blind History. We're into season 4, and I don't even know how many episodes, but I've gone down the rabbit hole on so many of these, and this person today is one of those people I knew absolutely nothing about except the movie. And now I find myself reading stories about Central Asia and about Arabia that I never thought I'd be interested in. His name is T.E. Lawrence. He is better known as Lawrence of Arabia. And thanks to Anthony Medderer, my co-host, who is also the MD of Taylor Blinds and Shutters, who are proudly the people who bring you these fantastic history podcasts, if we do say so ourselves. Anthony told me we've got to do an episode on this guy. So it's thanks to you that I'm interested in what his life meant and what his relevance is in the modern era, but also these incredible romantic stories of what happened in the Arabian desert, you know, almost 100 years ago. It's quite something. It's extraordinary. So, Ant, what got you interested in Thomas Edward Lawrence?
So I saw the movie like you did, and extremely successful movie. I think it had quite a few Oscars. And it was a great story. And then I, you know, looked into it, and there was so much more. Actually, his life is more interesting than the movie, to be honest. And yes, so I just like you said, I just dug more and more into it, and it's a really great figure.
Well, let's give you the quick executive summary on Lawrence of Arabia, and then you can listen to some of the stories that Anthony and I have discovered about him. He was a British archaeologist, an army officer, a diplomat, a map maker, and a writer. He was well known for his role in the Arab Revolt from 1916 to 18. And he took part in the campaign against the Ottoman Empire during the First World War. And really, this guy was quite an amazing human being. He was eventually called Lawrence of Arabia, famously, and featured in that 1962 film called Lawrence of Arabia with Peter O'Toole, based on his wartime activities. But he was actually born out of wedlock in 1888 to his mother, who was a governess who ran away with his father. And his father obviously abandoned his family for the governess, so she must have been quite a looker. Or maybe she had the personality that he would inherit. But he had some brothers, and the beginning of his life was kind of ignominious, right? There wasn't a whole lot going on.
Not really, but in those days, this was seriously taboo what his dad did. You know, it shocked that upper class. I mean, because he was a landowner, it was family wealth. And he gave all of that up, obviously, for the governess, Sarah, I think her name was. And she was quite a strict mom and disciplinarian. So maybe the dad was scared of her in some way.
So he had these brothers, and all of them ended up going into war and fighting on the front. And I think he felt a little bit left out. He was, I think, the youngest. And he did go to university. He studied at Oxford. And he was, I think, an archaeologist, first of all. And then he volunteered for the British Army and was sent to the Arab Bureau, which is where his story really begins, because everything before then wasn't terribly remarkable.
But what went before then played a big role in what happened afterwards, because he was seen at school. They picked up that he was some sort of child prodigy. They saw that at the school he was going to in Oxford. But he didn't like the way traditional education was, and so he did his own thing. He loved archaeology. The museum up the road started seeing more and more of him. But the problem was at home. He was different to his brothers. They were very religious. The mom was very religious. I think she was trying to claw back some of her
respectability,
correct. Because, I mean, she caused the breakup of a marriage. She had 5 children that out of wedlock, et cetera, et cetera. So, and he wasn't interested in religion. So she tried to beat it into him. And I think that played a big, big role. A lot of strange behavioral traits that came out of this. There was a lot of guilt when he found out about what his dad really did. And so all of these things paved the way. But archaeology was his true love. And I think prior to him actually joining the army, he used to go on bicycle trips to Europe to look at all the castles of the Crusaders. And that's what he wrote his thesis on.
Yeah, he was obsessed with medieval knights and particularly the Crusades, and he would actually go around to cathedrals and chapels and make brass rubbings of the tombs of famous knights from history. So when he eventually got the chance to go to the Holy Land, it was you know, it was a dream come true for him.
And I think that's how he evolved. And he did spend, prior to the war breaking out, he spent quite a bit of time in the Middle East, also very much looking at the Crusades, where the journey was and all of that. And he just came to love the area.
I read an interesting thing about how he went to the castle of the famous, enormous castle in Palestine, or in the Levant, called the Crac de Chevalier, which is this enormous castle that was used during the Crusades. And, you know, even at that stage, and it still is a very dangerous place to go. Syria, especially now, is not exactly open for tourists, you know. And this guy was, he was traveling around there and taking it all in as a real, you know, a real fan of history and someone who I think we would have all got along with. But in the end, he was craving some real action. You know, he wasn't the sort of person to just sit around and admire old buildings and live in his imagination the life of a crusader. He wanted to actually take part in battle himself. And he couldn't find a better place than in the Middle East at that time. It was such a mess. The Ottoman Empire was more or less in control, and the Ottoman Empire had an army which was largely staffed by amateurs, but they were trained by the Germans. And of course, the Ottoman Empire was in an alliance with the Germans in the First World War, and, well, the approaching First World War. And the rest of the Middle East was sort of governed by these tribes. The Arabs were very distinctly different from the Turks and from the Persians. And there were also a lot of sort of scattered Bedouin tribes, which considered themselves to not belong to any nation at that stage. And Lawrence had this dream because he had enmeshed himself with the Arab people at that stage. He had this dream of helping them to achieve their independence. And fortunately for him, it came at just the right time, because as the First World War broke out, the Ottoman Turks declared a fatwa against a jihad, in fact, against the British. And this allowed him to undermine the Turkish Ottoman Empire by turning the Arabs against them and promising them some kind of freedom. That was the overall political story. But there are stories that go on underneath this, which are maybe more fascinating.
The British wanted to stir the pot and create this revolt. And he really was instrumental in doing that. And he started getting to know the leaders of quite a small group. In the beginning, there wasn't a lot of Arabs that were against Turkish rule. There was a minority that were causing uprisings, but that grew and grew and grew as they gained success. But Gareth, very much guerrilla-style tactics. So blowing up railway tracks, but not blowing up all the tracks, just blowing up specific areas, or blowing it up to the extent that it looked fine, but it would cause massive damage.
Yeah, so, as you say, guerrilla tactics, but we might even call it terrorism if we were the Ottomans at the time. And there was one distinct line which ran from, I think, from Istanbul right down as a spine into Arabia and through Medina, which is obviously the place where the Prophet Muhammad is buried. And this was a very important strategic line. And the Turks were caught completely unawares, because what Lawrence had done is he'd gone to meet a very important man in that part of the world, Sharif Hussein, who was effectively the boss, the emir of Mecca, which is obviously another important holy site. And he had some sons, Ali, Abdullah, and Faisal. And when Lawrence met Faisal, he reckoned, this is the guy who can help me lead a revolt against the Ottomans.
And he got very close to Faisal. I mean, that they formed a great partnership.
And Faisal was a very interesting man. I mean, in some ways he was, you know, he was that prototypical, stereotypical Arab prince who was, you know, violent and temperamental and difficult to understand. But he was also a tremendously thoughtful man and was well-read and understood instinctively military strategy. And I think that probably worked in Lawrence's favor, because from then on, as you rightly point out, the two of them had an incredibly successful campaign. I think the highlight of which was the siege of Aqaba, which is a port on the, I think, on the Red Sea, which is in that triangle between Sinai and the Arabian Peninsula. It's a very important strategic port as well, because Aqaba is one of the most important entries into the Red Sea. And I think that this raid, this siege, was immortalized in the movie by, you know, Lawrence of Arabia on his camel rushing down into Aqaba and seizing it. But there was an interesting story that he, in order to get the Arabs to stop just skirmishing on the outskirts of the battle, he actually told the leader of one of the tribes, "Are you people here to work or are you just here to watch?" And this chief, this sheikh, decided, "Screw you." And he rounded up his men. And before Lawrence knew what was going on, they were all heading down into the valley to meet the Ottomans.
This is without any, not one single day of battlefield training. So Lawrence had no training in terms of going to war, because he was sitting in an office, as you said, in the beginning with the army in Cairo. And he had archaeological background and he'd obviously surveyed the region. So his big strength was he knew the desert backwards and he could speak the language. So he was a brilliant linguist and archaeologist for that matter. But what came out now as he started getting involved in the war was, yes, he was adventurous, definitely adventurous, but he was a genius tactician. And a lot of people don't necessarily know that, but he was very tactical and an instinctive leader. I think in one of his first battles, one of the leaders of the Arabs got into a fight with another one of his sub-lieutenants, and he had to sort it out. And what he did was the leader at that time killed the other individual. And so Lawrence had to take control, and he ended up actually killing that person that started it. And he felt that that was the fairest thing to do. So and I think in the end, what they said about him, even Winston Churchill said that any one of those Arabs would have given their life for T.E. Lawrence.
Well, it's interesting if we can go back to Aqaba for a second, because it wasn't all heroism and romanticism. When the main tribe had descended into the valley to meet the Turks, Lawrence took to his camel and he was riding down at great speed, as, you know, is portrayed so beautifully in the movie. The thing they leave out of the movie is that he shot his camel in the head by mistake on his way down. He was flung into the air and landed and was knocked unconscious. And actually didn't participate in the battle at all. When he woke up, he realized that they'd won. But it was some hours after the battle had already been concluded.
I didn't even know that. That's crazy, eh?
not exactly the most sterling performance by him during that battle. And another interesting thing about bringing the Arab tribes together, because really they weren't a distinct nation at that stage. He gathered them all in the desert and they all had their Bedouin tents. And after a couple of weeks of all of them discussing the various options and how they should, you know, amalgamate and which chief would be the chief of all the chiefs and all the rest of it, he noticed that what had started off as 12 distinct fires around which people sat eventually became 3. And his goal was eventually to make that 1, so that all the men were sitting around the same fire. And then he knew he was in a position to suggest that they could be a nation. And of course, the saddest thing about this is that the British and the French betrayed them with the Sykes-Picot deal, which was signed all the way over in Europe. And this was really humiliating to him, because he'd promised Faisal and all the other Arabs that this was going to be their chance at independence. And they were betrayed by the colonial powers.
And you know that the British knew that they were going to betray. So they just said what was needed at the time to pull them together. But Lawrence really believed in them getting an independence. And, you know, after his death, Faisal did in the end become king. I know his brother became king of Jordan for many, many years. So that did ultimately come out as such, but under French and British rule.
You know, there are so many things about this that are in a way perfect for movies, and you can see why they've made this movie. But there was this story of how he had to cross the desert after capturing Aqaba, and he had to do it himself. There were no telephone lines. There were no telegrams. And if he didn't go himself, they wouldn't have believed that any of the stories were true if he'd sent an emissary. And he went all the way from Aqaba across the most difficult parts of the Sinai Desert back to Cairo to tell the British in Cairo that this is what had happened. And obviously he there made significant inroads, and they gave him armored tanks and all the rest of it. And he was eventually able to take a lot more of the territory over for these newly independent Arabs, or so he thought. And he was dressed in their clothes. You know, he used to wear silk Arab traditional dress. And this was most unlikely for an English soldier. And as you say, he spoke Arabic very, very well and really got into the lives of these people. In fact, so much so that there are soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan and soldiers who are posted in Jordan and in Saudi Arabia that are American that read Lawrence of Arabia's original writing in order to determine for themselves the best course of action to make peaceful, meaningful, and deliberate alliances with the people of that region. So even now, his work is useful in the U.S. military and is prescribed reading, in fact.
That was definitely the case with Afghanistan and the wars in Iraq, etc. That there was a lot that they looked into that. Because what happened was he actually said that one of the reasons why he wore the white flowing Arab clothes was, yes, it was cool, it was the right clothes to wear, but also because then the Arabs could speak to him and sort of know what his character was about. So that was definitely fundamental to him actually being part of them. And yeah, he really felt he was part of them for those 3 or 4 years.
Now, the end of his life wasn't as glorious as this part that we've just discussed. And I think it's worth mentioning the way that he died and perhaps some of the aspects of his personal life, which people might not know. You know how he died. He was killed in a motorcycle accident, right?
Yes, and he loved motorcycles. And
apparently he had quite a collection.
Yeah, he had 7 different Brow Superiors, I think they're called. I don't know if I pronounce it right because I don't know that brand, but dubbed the Rolls Royces of motorcycles.
Mm-hmm.
And then May the 13th, he was riding the motorcycle in 1935 and speeding through the English countryside. And he came across 2 boys on bicycles. So he swerved to miss them and he hit his head on the asphalt. Oof. And he died 6 days later. So that's basically, yeah, it's a sad end. But prior to that, he was very reclusive. If we can look at him as an individual, he would be brilliant and brave, boisterous and aggressive during the war, but he could also be very private and reclusive and even hidden. So 2 sides to the coin.
Well, they say that he was a closeted gay man as well, and that he had a couple of relationships while he was in Arabia with some younger Arabian men. And he wrote about these very openly in his memoirs. And he wrote several books, including The 7 Pillars of Wisdom, which you can still get in good bookstores now. But this may have played a part. He was also never really the same. You know, once he'd got back to England after being Lawrence of Arabia, he tried to re-enlist a number of times under fake names, and he kept on being outed as Lawrence of Arabia. And somehow his fame worked against him.
Yeah, I think when he got the fame, he didn't want it. I think there was a part of him early on because he really wanted to rewrite the guilt in his family and the Lawrence family, you know, for his dad. That I think he was driving himself for that, trying to take the pain of the guilt away that drove him. But when the fame came just after the war, he ran away from it. I mean, a lot of statements you can see have said that I'm just an ordinary man. So he was running away from it at that stage.
In the end, this was an incredible life, and a life which was surprising in that this man from England had an enormous say in the way that the borders of the Arab world are to this day decided. And in fact, Osama bin Laden says that it was Lawrence of Arabia who fragmented the Islamic world into all these states, which seem to be very arbitrary. And I suppose you could trace a lot of this back to him, although he was not entirely solely responsible.
Yeah, I think for one man to have done that, that's tough. But he definitely played a big role. But when the movie came out, it was banned in parts of the Middle East, in Jordan, and then also in Turkey. Even as late as October 2014, the president of Turkey declared that Lawrence was one of the greatest enemies of the Middle East and Turkey, and even to such an extent worse than the Islamic State, the terrorist group. So those are very powerful negative words.
Well, it's interesting because there's such mixed feelings about him in modern Middle Eastern circles. There are some people whose grandfathers fought alongside him and who revere him as being this man who had a lot to do with Arab independence. And then there are those who credit him with coming up with the guerrilla and terrorist tactics that were eventually assimilated into ISIS and into the Taliban and into many other terrorist organizations. So there's a lot of love and there's a lot of hate.
Even Henry Kissinger, they said he'd done this diplomacy of shuffling between the two parties to try and get the deal through. That was actually Lawrence of Arabia.
Well, I mean, not a boring life at all. And if you haven't seen the movie, it's worth watching. There are parts of it that are obviously dramatized. But the actual life of this man was something else. It was colorful beyond belief.
Maybe a summary is just a curious scholar and in his school career that picked it up in a university, a brilliant linguist and archaeologist, and then a shrewd diplomat as you saw through his life. as I mentioned earlier, instinctive in his leadership because he never had any formal training. He was a British soldier, avid writer, and a genius tactician, and a seminal figure in shaping and reshaping of Arabian politics.
Yeah, I'm glad that we found out all this this stuff about him, and I hope that in listening to this podcast, you've learned a little bit about the man. Certainly not boring, definitely a massive contribution to the world, and someone who continues to exert an influence on society today. That's Lawrence of Arabia. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
George V tried to knight him in 1918. It was the first time in 900 years of British monarchy that someone refused the knighthood, because he thought King George V was going to tell him how to solve the problem and give independence to the Arabs. And he just wanted to knight him. So he turned around and walked out, and the befuddled king apparently didn't know what to do.
Cliffcentral.com.